Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, banshee flying, space mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what's the point of galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
From athletic stuff like a full court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff like a half mile stroll. Get those steps in. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
All right, everybody, this is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. Zach Haas is our guest. And did you know, Zach, that I call it the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast because I only have 9 fingers?
No, I didn't.
You didn't know that?
Oh.
You had, what were you signing up for?
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Like, look.
That's awesome.
You had no clue. You just thought some regular 10-fingered dude had a podcast called the Nine Finger Chronicles.
Oh, I just thought, like, it's a great name. Like, I'm like, I like it. Catchy. That's awesome. That's awesome.
That's sweet, dude. Dude, that right there made my day better, just so you know. Awesome. Love it.
That's awesome.
Okay. Oh my God. Did you, just out of curiosity, did you like think, why does he call it Nine Finger Chronicles before you came on?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Yeah.
Okay.
I was like, yeah, it's a cool name. Yeah, I don't know what the reason is, but yeah, that's neat. That's sweet.
Well, welcome, my friend, to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. It would be weird if I called it the Nine Finger Chronicles and had all 10 fingers, though. I feel like it would be like kind of weird, but that's hilarious, man. Love it. Where do you live? What do you do for a living?
So I live in Southeast Wisconsin. So for people that are familiar with Wisconsin, I'm kind of near like Fond du Lac, north of Milwaukee area. Mm-hmm. And for a living, what I do, so I own and operate a habitat company called Creek Bottom Land Management. So doing everything from consulting work to all the habitat work, food plots, trees, water, you name it. And before that, I actually had an extensive career as an aquatic biologist for almost 20 years where I managed ponds, lakes, reservoirs, you name it. So pretty much if there's a problem out there you've seen with water, I probably have taken care of it at some point in my extensive career. But then also I'm the inventor of EH Defense, so kind of handling that EHD issue we have out there in the Midwest for whitetail deer.
Ooh, lots to talk about today. You got any kids?
I do. I have two kids. I have a boy and a girl. They're at that age of 9 and 7 that they're a handful. So it's nice when they're off to school sometimes.
Who's older, the boy or the girl?
My boy.
Okay. All right. Yep. Do they fight a lot?
Yeah. My daughter tries to stay to her own. Like she just wants to draw and do all that. But my boy he's all fire. Like he wrestles and all that kind of stuff. Like he's just constant energy and fights with her nonstop.
Yeah. I think that is my favorite part. And I'm obviously being sarcastic here about being a parent is I joke with my wife and I say, is 12 to still young enough to drop them off at the hospital? Like there's days where I try so hard and I tell myself like, dude, you have so much patience, or I try to have so much patience every day towards all the problems in life. But there are days, man, where I just want to like get rid of them. I hate to say it, but it's the truth, dude.
I always joke with even my wife. I'm like, so when they get to teenager age, is it okay if I just move to my cabin?
I
don't want to deal with the hormones.
The hormones, yeah, dude. Well, my daughter in today is, so 5 days she turns 13 and then I'll have a teenager in the house, which blows my mind that I'm even, number one, I'm even allowed to have kids in my house after what I've done, and not like in the bad way, but just like, like God said, you're going to be a good dad. And after knowing my past, right? Like, whatever.
Yep.
And so I guess that's probably me trying to right all the wrongs that I've done in the past, but I don't know. It's kids are so awesome and not awesome all in the same breath. I don't know. I don't know how else to explain it.
It's a different challenge. Put it that way.
Yep. So, Southeast Wisconsin, are you a Brewers fan?
I am. Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't follow baseball super close. I'm probably more a football fan than anything, but
you you live in a spot where you're like, you're actually fairly close to Chicago and probably about the same distance to Green Bay.
Oh yeah. Without a doubt. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So who do you root for?
Oh, for me, it's always Green Bay.
Yeah.
It's, I'm a Packer fan. Die hard there.
Okay. All right. Cool.
I mean, I have a lot of friends that are Bears fans, so it's like you have a mixed relation.
Yeah, sure. I feel you. The last thing I want to say is here's one of my favorite things about Wisconsin, and it's not just on certain times of year. I feel like it is all year round that if you want to go to a restaurant, or they even have restaurants that are 100% fish fry restaurants where that's all they serve is like fried fish, fried white fish of some kind, and you know, French fries and coleslaw. Dude, that's one of my favorite parts about Wisconsin is like being able to go and go to a fish fry whenever you want.
Oh, that's a big deal. Like if you go to a bar up here or a restaurant and they don't have a Friday night fish fry, it's not the place you want to be.
Yeah, they're not going to make it, right?
No.
No. Even like the foreign restaurants, like Indian cuisine has French, has fried food for everybody. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Cool, man. Let's have a conversation about what you do for a living. But before we do that, I got to say thank you to our partners over here at the Nine Finger Chronicles. First, I want to send a huge shout out to one of the longest partners of the Nine Finger Chronicles, and that is Wasp Archery. Wasp makes a really good lineup of mechanical and fixed blade broadheads. They're manufactured. Most of their heads are still manufactured in the United States, which is awesome. I'm a huge fan of that. I'm a huge supporter of that. Awesome material, awesome design. And I'm that kind of guy where once you find something that really sticks, like for example, my arrow setup, I love my arrow, my bow hunting arrow setup, and I don't want to change it because it works for me. Right. And a lot of that has to do with putting big holes, two holes, actually, one, the entry, one, the exit. And that's what I'm going for every time I shoot a deer, and my Wasp broadheads do a ton of damage. So go check out wasparchery.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Vortex Optics. It is turkey season, and we're knocking on turkey season here really close. Depending on where you're at in the country, there is a lot of seasons that open up in March. Go get a red dot, go get a Vortex red dot for your shotgun, and help your, you know, I like it because it is it's a true sight for putting the dot on the head, even if it's just a little off and I got some turkey fever, pull the trigger and it works just fine. So go to vortexoptics.com and see what red dot will fit your liking. So vortexoptics.com. Next on the list is Code Blue Sense. You've heard me talk about this a million times before, but my favorite product that they make is the Rope-A-Dope Mock Scrape Kit. Actually, I don't think this weekend, but next weekend, I'll be going to the farm, do a little shed hunting before the knee surgery, and do some habitat improvement. I'm actually going to be doing some hinge cutting and some just cutting down trees that have, you know, no undergrowth underneath of them, and trying to get some sunlight to the forest floor to make it thick. But outside of that, they have real synthetic deer urines. They have scent elimination products. I love the Rope-A-Dope mock scrape kit. And what's this here? It's the Grave Digger. They have this, it's like a powder. It's like dirt mixed with scent. You can put in the scent in the scrape, and I match that with a good trail camera, and I get pictures of deer visiting that scrape almost all year round. CodeBlueSense.com, discount code NFC20. And I pair that mock scrape with a Reveal trail camera. These guys are doing some amazing things, and I know for a fact that everybody kind of needs to stand by because they're working on something that is pretty sweet coming out. And the guy didn't tell me exactly how long from now it's going to be, but they're going to be doing some amazing things with their trail cameras. And so go check out tacticam.com/cameras, and I don't know, go check it out. So the reveal trail cameras. All right, Zach, you've been in habitat. Are you a habitat manager or are you a habitat specialist? What's your title?
I guess I always call myself a land management specialist just because I deal with stuff just above and beyond hunting too, you know, so it's just pretty much whatever people need. I mean, that's one thing as a consultant for so many years, like even when I was just doing pond work, it was always trying to figure out what other things a client needed done.
Yeah.
So really there's no job too small, and I'll figure out a way to get it done.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So I want to shelf the habitat talk just for a little bit. Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about, you said you had 20 years of experience working with ponds, waterways and things like that. Talk to me about that 20 years. What's it like being a water management, or what'd you call yourself?
So I was an aquatic biologist.
An aquatic biologist. What does an aquatic biologist do?
Yeah. So, I mean, it all starts obviously. So I went to a 4-year college and all that, got a degree in biology, water resource management. And when I got started, I actually was hired on as a research director. So that's where I was testing products, bringing them up to the market. Like I helped to bring out one of the herbicides used for actually Eurasian water milfoil onto the market. I did that in 2016. But overall, what we did is, I mean, everything, obviously pond and lake management wise. So we would take care of invasive species, nutrient issues, fishery management, aeration systems, I mean, I dealt with everything from, you know, your HOA, COA subdivisions. We did corporations for stormwater pond work, campgrounds, fishing reservoirs, private lakes, private ponds. And, you know, so it was a combination of, like, we'd treat algae, we would treat invasive species. We would go and do bacteria and enzyme applications for nutrient remediation. One of my clients was one of the larger zoos in Wisconsin where I had to restore the fishery because they're that was literally the fish they were taking to put in their aquarium, and they were awful when I started, but I had to fix the fishery and get it back where the fish were healthy again. So, yeah, I mean, pretty much it's one of those things that, I mean, I was taking care of anything from your small, what people would almost call a deer pond, right, up to thousands of acres of lakes. Yeah. And they all had their different niche, you could say. I mean, some were private, some were public, so we had to deal with a lot of regulation as well. But overall, I mean, it was a fun career just because you got, I mean, I traveled the whole entire state, parts of the Midwest, and man, it was just neat to take a pond that I'd walk up and it would be completely destroyed because they've never taken care of, and bring that pond back to life. And then just to see the happiness of the client or, mm-hmm. you know, the little kid fishing, because it was like, wow, you brought back to my childhood, you know, just from obviously working intensely on it for a season.
Yeah. Love it. All right. A huge issue in the Midwest right now. And I know, and I'm talking specifically about Iowa farming practices, runoff, you hear those things. And when it comes to ponds and waterways is just how saturated they are with nitrates and other chemicals that naturally would never be there. Okay.
Right.
Talk to me a little bit about that experience and how not only does it affect the water, but the rest of the wildlife that come into contact with that water.
Yeah. So, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, right? I mean, the farming practices, and not to knock farmers, but it's changed, right? It's evolved where it's trying to take every inch of ground we can to plant that extra row of corn. And unfortunately, we've lost all the, what I call the better management practices. So buffer strips, these tree rows, doing swales, all that stuff's gone to the wayside because it's all about getting that extra row of crop ground. And what we've seen, like in our own state, for instance, just because of agricultural practice change, we've lost 50% of the habitat for the brook trout. So we're literally losing native fish species because of just destroying our ecosystems. And a lot of it deals with excess phosphates, excess nitrogens. And what we're doing is we're accelerating the process. It's called eutrophication. So that's the aging of a water body. So we're speeding that up. And what we're seeing is it's literally killing off all these native invertebrates, insects, fish species because they can't deal with pollution. Mm-hmm. And if nothing's done, right, we're going to keep on losing habitat left and right. So it's not only is affecting what's in the water, but that's even there too. There's a correlation even with the whole EHD issue going on with the water quality getting destroyed. Mm-hmm. So we're actually making it more prevalent that we have harmful, noxious species of insects. We have more planktonic algae blooms that can have different toxins within them, different bacteria pathogens. So, I mean, all this stuff that is bad out there for our ecosystem is literally exploding in the same rate as agriculture is expanding.
Yeah, it's crazy. And that's a subject that I would love to talk more about because I truly feel like there are certain parts of the state. Let's take tiling your fields, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole goal of tiling your fields, correct me if I'm wrong here, is to get water out of the field so there's no flooding, correct?
Absolutely. Yep.
But at the same time, then doesn't that make a field more susceptible to drought if the water is getting out of there really, really quickly?
Absolutely, because I mean, what we're doing is we're expediting how fast that water leaches through the soil. So instead of letting it naturally go, you know, through the system, we're getting it out of there as quick as possible. And we're seeing that a lot, like where they're doing it more so is areas that were historically wetlands and marsh ground. They're doing a lot of tiling in those spots. But yeah, I mean, now if you get a dry year, then the farmers are going like, why are my crops growing? Well, because you got rid of all your water. And when it comes to soil health, and this goes into food plotting and all that stuff, I mean, soil moisture is so important when it comes to health of having the right bugs and, you know, bacterias and all that stuff, all these, you know, microbes in the soil. Well, if you keep drying it out and all these different things, you're destroying the soil over time too.
Yeah. I watched an interesting documentary a couple years ago about locks and dams not only on the Mississippi River, but on a lot of the major rivers in the United States, including dams on smaller rivers and stuff like that. And long story short, they said that these dams were built for flood control. And it was a way, it was this documentary, the end of it was basically like, we shouldn't even be living on floodplains because the floods that happen when it rains a lot are massive when the floodplain itself used to absorb all that. Right. And now we decided that's where we want to live and farm. And then we got a problem. Now we have these big problems because of that. So once again, it's almost like man stepping into nature and just screwing it all up.
Yep, pretty much.
Yeah.
You mess with Mother Nature, she fights back.
Exactly. Okay. And so what are some of the common things that you see when you're working in these ponds and lakes that connect back to like maybe tiling of fields or fertilizers and herbicides and pesticides and things like that?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest things that we see is obviously it's such a high pollutant discharge rate that mm-hmm. we've never witnessed before. Like we were doing testing back when I did my undergrad on that. I mean, it was alarming the rate of phosphorus and nitrogen that were hitting these systems. And when it comes to water, nitrogen and phosphorus are your limiting growth factors.
Yeah.
And what also speeds up aging. So pretty much by doing that, instead of letting the normal timeline happen, we've sped it up. And when nothing happens, oh yeah, we destroy things very rapidly. And then it goes all downstream because now we're pumping this into, like, say, a river. Well, that river then has all the tributaries and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But then even chemical-wise, I mean, yeah, we're seeing the effects where, you know, these herbicides then get in the water system. They're killing off, because like invertebrates, amphibians, and insects, especially the better native species, are very susceptible to pollution where they'll essentially, we're killing them off. So we've seen these streams where I'll go in and it's just a dead zone. There's nothing in it. Yeah. And another key point would be like you look at Lake Erie or even in Sturgeon Bay in Wisconsin, we had it for a little bit, but you literally have these dead zones. So they're 100% anoxic, meaning there's no oxygen and there's also no living life. So like the one in Sturgeon Bay for the longest time was about 60 acres of anoxic zone. No life whatsoever.
And that's because of chemicals? And
chemicals and fertilizers and all that kind of stuff.
So damn. Yeah,
and then Lake Erie even has it worse. I mean, I don't even know how many hundreds of acres they have in anoxic zone. And that's actually the reason why, too, you'll see really big walleyes in there is because of the nutrient influx, but you're actually making the fish grow more rapidly and they die quicker. And then we get these areas where you have these massive die-offs. And yeah, before you know it, you have these big voids where you will not see anything from the top of the water to the bottom of the water. There will not be a single living creature. And a lot of that is pollution-based.
Damn. So here's what's crazy, right? Like, have you ever been part of a conversation with, like, between, let's say, the Department of Natural Resources and, I don't know, maybe a lobbyist that works with farmers or fertilizer or pesticide companies or something like that? And obviously, they don't want a ban on their products because they want to make money. But
Right. Let's
be honest, it's one of the sole reasons, not the sole reason, but it's one of the major reasons why we're seeing this, these issues.
Yeah, and it's a weird thing. Like I dealt with, like in our own state, I dealt with the DNR my whole career, right? And they regulate us to nobody's, you know, mm-hmm. to the end of time, pretty much. They'll regulate what we can do in the water to improve it.
Yeah.
But when it came to the farmer, we always were kind of told like, well, that's just the farmers. Just leave them be.
Yeah.
So there's no regulation on that side, but then we're overregulated trying to fix it. So it's weird. It's completely backwards of what it should be.
Yeah. And that's a huge thing of what's kind of happening in Iowa right now. We're kind of hitting a boiling point on this next governor election where there was all of this energy put into trying to help the water quality in the state of Iowa. And then all of a sudden it just got shelved and all the funding got cut and nobody wants to talk about clean water anymore. And we are the highest state in the nation for cancer. There's a correlation there, you know, there's a correlation there. So talk to me a little bit about these dead zones in these fisheries whether it is an entire pond. And I'll tell you this, my family has this farm and it's like a 2-acre pond. It's nothing huge. I would guess maybe 2 acres, maybe a little less, but it was fun. You go fish, you catch some smaller bass, you catch some smaller bluegills. That's about it. Maybe a crappie is still left in there, but it all died this past, I think it was this past fall. And we don't really know what happened. My stepdad has some ideas of his own of what he thought happened. He mentioned something about the pond turning over and there was too much like algae or something in there that started choking the fish out. Talk to us a little bit about these dead zones or what happens when you have these mass kill-offs of fish.
Yeah, so, and it also depends on time of year, right? Like, so like we'll see a lot of winter kills and stuff that way where there was no aeration or something that present and essentially you just ran out of oxygen. Mm-hmm. But the best way to kind of describe it is if you've ever been on a lake and you've almost smelled like a rotten egg smell, mm-hmm. there's actually so many gases building up. And when you have a pond, let's just say it's 10 feet deep, you have, so there's a barrier in there in the middle of the pond. It's called a thermocline. So it's an invisible barrier that separates the top and the bottom for simplicity. Yeah. And in the fall, it goes through fall turnover. So what happens is the whole water body flips. So all summer long, there's no aeration to break that up. What happens is all those gases build up down there. So when that turnover happens, all those gases are released, goes into the fishery and essentially suffocates and kills the fish off. They can't breathe. They can't deal with any of that. So it's common to see that. Like in fall, we see the biggest oxygen crashes and something really to kind of watch for. And a lot of that is derivative of plants and algae. So if you have a lot of plants and algae that are growing in the pond, they're all dying obviously in the fall. So they're stripping all the oxygen out of that water. And then when you have all these gases from decay, that on turn will kill the fishery. So it's a combination of oxygen crashing and then the gases escaping finally into that upper, you know, region of the water body.
And that could potentially be just like years and years and years of leaves falling off trees and then hitting. Is there a way to fix that?
Aeration would be the number one thing to start with, because when you start aerating, for one, you're going to boost your oxygen levels, your dissolved oxygen levels in the water body. So you're going to get these levels, you know, let's say like you're at, so minimum requirement for fish is usually 5 milligrams per liter is what a fishery needs. Well, when you do aeration, you're bumping that to like 10 to 12. So you're doubling the oxygen availability. So when you do have those crashes, you're actually supporting that decrease of oxygen level. But that aeration alone also will kind of start the life process of the bottom of the pond. So everything starts at the bottom of the pond, no matter what. All plants, all algae, no matter the species, they start from the bottom of the pond. And then they grow up. So when you can start making the bottom healthier and getting actually beneficial bacteria to start working on decay a little quicker, working on oxygen, taking away phosphorus, nitrogen, what you're doing is actually help. As you fix that basin of the pond, you're going to fix the rest of the water. So it all starts down there. So like as a biologist, the top of the water could look great, but that's not telling us the story at the bottom. Yeah. And when you start getting all these years of muck and muck and muck, suddenly, before you know it, all those good bacteria that were there, we call them aerobic bacteria, so they use oxygen. Suddenly, they're switching to anaerobic bacteria. They don't need oxygen. They don't do a dang thing for your system. And now, you know, so like it's you have an acre pond, it's 10 feet deep. If you don't have aeration, they're only living at, let's say, 3 to 5 feet of water. Now you're letting them live through 10 feet so you can support more fish. So obviously, as fish are in the pond too, you know, they're peeing, they're pooping, so ammonia levels are going up. Organics are going up, but they're also stripping oxygen out of the water. So now you just doubled the volume so the fish can survive.
Yeah.
And aeration, when I always would do my consulting work and go to a client's pond, that was the number one thing I'd always recommend is we got to get air in this pond. We got to get this thing turning over nonstop. So the key is in a day, you want to turn that pond over like 3 to 5 times a day. So you're constantly recycling that. So the gases never build. They're always escaping. And you're feeding that oxygen into water and making it healthier.
Is there a difference between moving water and air, like actually blowing air into the bottom of the pond and then having it come up, that kind of aeration?
Yeah. So like there's a kind of a couple different ways. Like you have a fountain, you know, a decorative fountain where you see the guys throwing, they'll throw up in air. That does a little bit of oxygen. I mean, like I'd always tell people, an actual bottom diffused aeration system. So where diffusers, air diffusers are on the bottom of the pond, they do about 90% management, 10% aesthetics. Mm-hmm. Whereas a phone or something that throws water on the top is about like 70% aesthetics, 30% management. So when you're just aerating the top, you're just fixing, once again, that top of that invisible barrier. So that's why you got to get aeration on the bottom of the pond and diffuse air, not just like bubbles. You can't just have big bubbles. So you got to actually do a compressor with it has diffused diffusers on the bottom, and then it puts so many bubbles, these micro bubbles in the air, so you have so much surface volume to get more dissolved oxygen in the water.
Yeah, that's crazy. And that, how much does the motion of water, like, so here in Iowa, again, I'm using Iowa as an example because this is what I know. We have periods of heavy rain, right? That goes down into the soil and then it runs off into the smaller waterways, into the bigger waterways and things like that. And then it goes dry real fast. And then a lot, like the smaller ones are dry, the medium ones become stagnant water. And then you have this very low, slow moving into the bigger waterways. What impact does that have on like the wildlife and the fish in those areas?
Yeah. I mean, when you have moving water, for one, it's going to stay clear. I mean, even if a stream or a creek is, let's say, poor water quality, if it's moving constantly, you don't ever have time for these pathogens or these algae species to grow because they need that stagnant water. So like, for instance, I was on Lee Dukoski's farm actually last fall, and we were in a pond of his that was 100% surrounded by trees and had no wind action whatsoever. I mean, it was a dead zone down there. It was muggy. All the bugs were there. So he actually went down to clear all those trees because I said, got to get airflow across this because that's called atmospheric diffusion. So that's actually bringing oxygen just by natural water movement. So that's why even like, you know, some of your best trout streams and things that way will have a lot of different rocks and stones and all these things. And that'll help oxygenate the water, which you need from top to bottom for the fisheries, for the amphibians, for the reptiles, for the, you know, you name it. The whole food chain needs that oxygen. So when you have more rapids and movement and more air movement, that the better.
Okay. All right, cool. All right. So we talk, I want to transition into the wildlife part of this now, this water. When you have these dead zones in these big lakes, or you have these super nitrated, and high nitrates, high phosphates in the waterway, and it's in the water and stuff like that. How does that then affect the non-marine species? Because everything drinks water.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
Correct. So yeah, I mean, the biggest thing, what will happen is, especially if you start getting where it's a nutrient loaded system, you're actually forcing the algae species to change. So you go from like what we see as algae is where that stringy, green, slimy, like that's, and that's actually good algae. That's filamentous algae. That's nothing to worry about. You start getting into more of the planktonics and the cyanobacteria species. And those are the ones that actually have toxins. So like when they drink, so for instance, like North Dakota, you probably maybe have heard of like where people bring their dogs out there duck hunting and you're not supposed to let your dog drink the water because they'll die.
Yeah.
Well, those are all harmful pathogens that essentially develop because it got so hot and all these things and all the nutrients. So when it comes to wildlife, if you have this, and I've seen it a lot of times too with like water tubs and stuff that way where it's let go. And before you know it, you have all these planktonic algae going, they're throwing toxins off. They're putting, there's more pathogenic bacteria out there. So now when you talk about like, let's say deer or coyote or whatever might come drink, well, you're talking about digestive issues. You're talking about, you know, they'll have different, there's different dermal toxins, gastrotoxins. I mean, you name it, there's a plethora of different toxins these bacteria and these algae species throw out and ultimately can kill the animal. So that's why I always say like water is so important on my list when it comes to land management, because, and good water, not just, oh, I got this little soup hole down here. Mm. No, you need high quality water because it's all about herd health. I mean, you're not going to give your dog a dish full of gross brown water. No, you're going to give them something clean and good for them. Right.
Right.
Whereas you would never give your pet something that you know is polluted. So it's the same thing with any animal. Like, I've even seen this in livestock. Like, I come from kind of a farming family, and my sister is a nutritional veterinarian, and we talk about it a lot. Where, all right, as soon as like a tank goes bad, and let's say there's another water source within that pasture, suddenly they start moving on to that other water source and they avoid the poor water. And they're way smarter than we are. I mean, humans as a species, we're idiots. You know, but animals, when it's a game of survival, they know bad and good. Yeah. And so they'll start moving. But if there's nothing else to move to, they're going to drink that poor water source and get sick, potentially die, and a whole, you know, line of options.
Yeah. With bad water, do you have you ever seen any correlations with poor water and EHD or poor water and CWD or any other deer or wildlife diseases?
Yeah, so nothing so much with CWD. Obviously, that's all the prions and deer interacting with each other. Like a scrape could do the same thing as anything else, right? EHD, you know, so like I did extensive research on that as my time as a research director and a biologist. And EHD is directly correlated to water quality. So like the midge fly, for instance, that causes EHD is completely, I shouldn't say it's not complete, but it's tolerated of high salinity issues. So like when you deal with people putting like minerals near water sources, the midge fly can deal with that where other insects and invertebrates can't. Mm-hmm. But also they need high organics. So the actually midge larva and the pupa stage, they both need high organic matter to feed on. So actually, the more degraded a water system is, the more organics there typically are, and you'll usually have more issues with them. Plus, the other part of this, and what I found is through kind of researching and doing my own field testing and all that, is the predator species of, let's say, the EHD midge require high water quality to survive. So things like dragonflies, different beetles, frogs. And those are the things that will be first affected by polluted water and will leave the system or be killed. Whereas the Culicolides midge isn't affected by pollution.
Yeah.
So it just expedites it when you have poor water quality.
That's crazy you say that, because there's a couple ponds that I've fished and there's dragonflies all over. You hear the frogs singing, all of that stuff. And then some other where the fishing's not so good, I don't hear the frogs. I don't see the dragonflies. And the rest of the marine, I don't know, the water connected wildlife that's there, which I didn't really put all any of that together until just now. So that's crazy that it can affect everything.
Yeah. And to me, that's like the, you know, cause it's one thing, like with my biologist eyes, I can see things that other people can't, which is that's experience. Right. But
yeah,
I will say like one of the biggest things is if you see a water body and there's no life in it, that's a big red flag. That means something really bad happened. And we've seen in a lot of streams we tested for invertebrates. Like the more polluted streams we'd seen, something we weren't seeing the same inverts. But as the water got cleaner, something there was freshwater sponges, there was different, you know, Daphnia and all these different things in the system. And to me, as that food chain's balanced, now you don't have all these issues. And to me, like the way I always compare it is like a pond that has bluegills, right?
Right.
If there's no predator of those bluegills, what happens? Well, you're going to have millions of little 3-inch bluegills that are thriving because there's no predator. And it's the same thing with the midge. If there's no predator, the food chain's busted. And that's just nature in general. You can't have a busted food chain in any region of the biology of life. So as we restore that, suddenly you see everything come back. And it's really crazy. Like you'll see, especially with frogs, because of how their skin is, they're quickly affected by, because they're absorbing everything, right? Whereas other species aren't. So they absorb all pollutants, all that stuff. So as soon as they sense it, they're gone.
Yeah.
You know, and you're talking amphibians and reptiles, depending on the species, can smell water or sense water a mile to 2 miles away. They're gone. They're going to go to that next clean source and fix that one while yours is just getting worse and worse.
I mean, that's just the perfect example of like the circle of life, right?
Right.
And how... Right. How I don't want to use the term fragile necessarily, but you tweak or take away something or change one thing out of it, it's going to affect every, it's a domino effect of everything else, right? In there. And I would say that water is probably one of, if not the top necessities of all wildlife. I mean, obviously there's animals that live in the deserts. I get it. But at the same time around, you know, deer hunt, you know, if there's no water to drink, deer aren't going to live on your farms or.
No, like I always laugh when the guys are like, they get all their water from the forage. Well, it's not true.
Yeah.
That's a big myth. I mean, they need one to 1.5 gallons of water a day.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lot of buds that they have to heat just browse, you know, so you can give them actual water and it deals with everything from fawning. I mean, if they don't have good water, they can abort their fawns, you know, and their growth, you know, especially like these natural, nice ponds that are made. They have natural minerals actually to make your deer bigger. You know, it's water to me, you know, and we always joke about it. It's like the cheat code of hunting because when you have water, and people call me crazy sometimes for saying this, but I think water is one of the ways you can actually pattern a buck in the rut. Because heat is not eating. It's a fact. He loses 28% of his body weight on average during the rut because he's not feeding. Well, he has to drink. It's no different. Like you said, like us going in the desert for 3 days, we don't have water, we're dead.
Yeah.
Same thing of deer. They don't drink, they're dead. So they have to drink.
Yeah. That's crazy. All right. We're going to do a little bit of a pivot and talk not necessarily about water anymore, but talk about habitat and what it is that you do. Because I know some guys who are like have some scientific backed credentials. They're really good at what they do. And then you have some guys who, I mean, I could call myself a habitat management specialist, right? And I don't know shit about
finger habitats. I like it.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. And I have a couple questions I want to get into it. But in your opinion, if there are people out there saying, I got this farm, I don't know if it's good or not, like, how do we weed out the good habitat specialists from the internet habitat specialists, if that makes sense?
No, it does. I mean, we're in a world where there's so many part-time consultants, it's crazy. It's like, it's kind of like way back when everybody wanted to have a hunting television show. The market got flooded. And to me, it's the biggest thing, you know, what I found is like, so obviously like my background, like I have a biology degree, but then obviously hunting experience and doing habitat work and all that. But it, to weed them really out, it's listening to what they say. Like you can tell those internet ones because they're just spitting out the stuff they heard off of a YouTube channel. Yeah. And it's, or the fad of the century, like saying everyone's talking switchgrass and then saying those consultants are now talking switchgrass. Never had planting it themselves.
Yeah.
You know, so I'd say watch for more like people talking about the trends versus what actually is realistic. You know, like I've gone on some consultants, you know, some consults after consultants, which is always funny to me when I get hired after someone's already walked a property. But then they start saying stuff that people want to do. And it's like these random dreams of like, well, yeah, just clear cut this 5 acres in the middle of your woods. Well, no consultant would ever recommend that. Yeah, you know, so to me, it's when you hear something that's not realistic, that's not a consultant you want to work with because they've never done it or they never have, you know, talked about it. So there's a lot of people that just want to be internet famous as consultants and it shows, honestly. And to me, it's I always laugh at the guys that they want to be consultant, but they haven't shot a buck in 10 years.
Yeah.
Well, you have no proof.
You know? Yeah.
That to me is a big red flag too.
Yeah. Do you think that's a necessity in order for someone to claim to be a habitat specialist and to provide a client with a better habitat or ecosystem for white-tailed deer that they have to be able to kill a mature white-tailed buck?
I would say just more practicing what they preach, you know, showing proof of what they've done. Like, so for instance, like I can show proof of my different habitat schemes of how they worked. You know, so I can bring up a picture and be like, and this is a food plot I did on a logging road. This is how I made a travel corridor, but I can show how the story evolved. And to me, it's important to show that what you are telling the people that they can shoot bucks, that you've done it, or you've at least been in the game to do it. You know, like, let's be honest, hunting a mature buck, it's tough. You know, it's not fun. Like I always tell my nephews and everything, I'm like, just shoot little bucks as long as you can because hunting trophy deer sucks. It's not fun. But then again, like I can tell someone like, hey, why should I put this wildlife pond in? I can tell a story about my own success or maybe a client's success of like, this is what we did. This is how they shot that deer. Well, now people have proof and a little bit of that feel good that, okay, it can work for me. Whereas if they're like, well, have you done this before? Oh, I've never done it personally and it's never worked for me, but you should do it.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound good.
Yeah. Okay. All right. The next question I have is this. All right. I've listened and had on this podcast several habitat management specialists who they all go through their theory of what, you know, where big bucks live, what they eat, like all this stuff. And throughout the course of my hunting career, I have run into, if I was going to walk onto a farm and you asked me the question, Dan, where do the big bucks live on this farm? I would say, find me the thickest multiflower rose, honey locust. Right. What's that bush that stays green all year round?
Buckthorn.
Buckthorn, like those types of places that are
buckthorn about a mile. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That those, and it's real fragile. Like you can break it real easy with one hand. Yeah. That stuff.
Yeah.
Just like Osage orange trees, just like the nastiest shit that everybody tells me that they should get cut out. Okay.
Right.
Everybody tells me these are no, but I look at that and I go, I don't give a shit what that particular plant does or does not do. I know that I kill big bucks in this stuff that is undesirable. How do you then talk to me and say, Dan, let me change your mind?
No, and honestly, I'm not changing your mind because I believe in the same theory. Like, you know, like I have one client that his whole property was overrun by honeysuckle, autumn olive, and buckthorn.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was parts where I'm like, this is way too thick. Like the deer don't go into this spot.
Yeah.
Well, those areas we cleaned up. Well, then, you know, if I would took out everything, I just made a park setting, which is never what we want to do. Right. So, I mean, yeah, they're invasive, but we have to work with invasives as well. So if you take everything out because you're, you know, you want to be a native guy, that's not realistic for deer hunting. And so like, for instance, even like we have a native shrub up here called prickly ash. And I know of guys that go and cut it and spray it. And I'm like, what are you doing? That's where I find my most sheds. That's where my bucks bed. I mean, like even I was just on my property yesterday shed hunting, and that's where all my buck beds and rubs were. They're all in a thick covey of prickly ash. So to me, I'm not gonna even try to change your mind because I agree with you. Like, I want that thick cover. And if it has to be that it's invasives, I just work with it. I cut in travel corridors. I make sun pockets, things that way. But you can't take it all away because unless you're trying to do this 20, 30 year plan down the road by getting your native shrubs and all this stuff into there, it's not realistic.
Okay. I gotcha. I've heard these guys talk and almost to a point of arrogance about certain things like that. And I'm like, I get it. Right. I get this is the goal is to remove invasive species and to do all of these things to make it more compatible to deer. But I've hunted on farms my entire life that hold big deer that the bark is literally chewed off most of the trees, the younger trees, because of horses and cattle that gets in them and things like that. And I've had to find my way, you know, work my way around all those. And then where do you find them? Next to the creeks in the biggest patch of, you know, beggar's lice, cockabers, and multiflower rose that a guy doesn't ever want to walk through. So it's funny how all of that works.
Oh yeah. Without a doubt. I mean, and to me, like I have such a, you know, my biggest thing is you're only as good as the people you surround yourself with. So like I have a lot of people that, And probably because of my schooling too, but like I have guys that specialize in prairie restoration. I have guys that are foresters, loggers. I mean, I have this big network of all these guys. So I bounce ideas off of them. And, you know, like even there's a big habitat company I work with to a lot of times install some prairies, bigger prairies that I have. And they'll even, he has the same philosophy as I do. He's like, you can't get rid of all your invasives. He's like, that's what's building your land, your habitat. Unless you want to drop a bomb on your property and not have deer hunting for 5 years, go ahead. But to me, I want to shoot a deer every single year, if possible. Yeah. I don't want to be like 5-10 years down the road, I'll get another mature deer. No. And to me, like I battled invasive species in the aquatic world forever. So there was some invasives that we dealt with that was like, it's not worth the fight. Right. You're going to waste more money, more time trying to fight this to maybe get it ready for natives, or you just work with it and you build habitat around it and incorporate into the design.
Yeah. Okay. So a guy calls you and he says, hey, come take a look at my property. You drive to his property, you step out of your truck. What's the first thing you're doing when you walk that property and what you're looking for?
Yeah, so first and foremost, I go over goals, right? That's, to me, it's because not all the goals are the same. Like, not every guy wants to shoot a 150, 180. Some guys just want to see more deer. So I go through all the goals. You know, what are they doing? Are they bow hunters? Are they gun hunters? Do they do both? And first things I'm kind of looking at is when I'm walking through that property is, so I have a couple, I guess you could say, criteria I'm looking for the whole time. So I'm always looking for, all right, how open is their timber stand? Do they need logging? Do they need select cutting? Do they need hinge cutting? Mm-hmm. Do they have bedding pockets? Can we work with a contour? What kind of water do they have? Sometimes guys are like, well, I got the swamp. I'm like, that's not the water we want. You know, what kind of food do they have? Is it just woody browse, or do they have the ability to put in actual food plots and forage sources or trees? Yeah. You know, so I'm kind of going through that whole list of, you know, the main basics, food, cover, water. And then the other part of it is I'm looking at access. Like, all right, how are we going to get to these spots, these money spots? Because I always tell my clients, I'm like, I'll get birdie, like a German short hair pointer would, when I'm like, this is a spot. Like, I get super excited and off task. Like, telling my ADHD kicks in where I'm like, oh, all right, we got to stay here. But then I'm thinking, okay, how do we set up on this? Or can we even set up on it? Or is it realistic? But another thing too, I'm looking at is trail systems, how people are actually utilizing their land. Like, I've had some people, I go on there and there's just a trail that guts the property. Oh, that's not good. You know, we never want to go through the dead center of our property because we're pushing everything out that way. So I'm looking at, can we incorporate a perimeter trail system, then build off that? So to me, there's so many things I'm looking at, you know, but it ultimately comes down to food, cover, water, and access. I'd say those are my primary four.
Okay. Yeah, that's how do you deal with clients who have unrealistic goals? Like, I'm going to be extreme here on this example, but I have 20 acres and I want to kill a Boone and Crockett caliber deer every single year.
I mean, luckily I haven't really had one.
Okay.
I mean, for the most part, we kind of hashed that out early on.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm very kind of not blunt on the point, but like, if someone has that really unrealistic goals, be like, well, what do you have going on for you in the area? What's your actual quality of the deer? What's the biggest buck you've actually heard of killed in the area? And they might be like, oh, 142. Yeah. Okay, well, you're not shooting 170. Just throw that in the trash can because it's not happening. So what's the best buck we can get out of this? You know, so then we start talking about that and kind of weeding out the real goal of the land. And if it's not something they want, then it's like a matter of like, well, do you want to just actually set up this property for selling if your goal isn't right? Because then we can just make this turnkey. You can off it to someone else and go and find that property that has that real big deer you want.
Yeah. Yeah. Given your profession, your professional opinion, how many acres does it take to actually manage a deer herd?
Oh, I mean, to actually manage a true deer herd, I think you're north of 500-600 acres.
Okay.
I mean, to really actually say, I don't have to worry about people. Mm-hmm. And even then, I mean, I've been on some of those bigger chunks. And if you don't have the right makeup of a property, it still isn't enough.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, I mean, I've been on some really cool farms that have had everything. They've had crazy cover, crazy food, water everywhere. And it's like, okay, you're probably housing all your deer. But once again, it always goes back to the actual biology of the animal. And that's where I kind of try to always bring it in is every deer 100% goes on an excursion, no matter what. Yeah. It's inevitable. It happens. So there is a chance that buck still is going to leave your land and get killed by the neighbor that owns 10 acres.
Yeah.
It's just part of it. I don't care if you have 1,000 acres because it all depends on the quadrant of that buck. It's so like I always split up my properties into quadrants because your northeast corner might be the southwest corner of a buck's range. Well, there's no stopping that. I mean, that deer has his range he wants to be in. So you just got to try to provide everything you can in that quadrant for him to actually enjoy it more than, let's say, the neighboring property.
Yeah.
So to me, there's no really right or wrong answer on that because I've also known of properties that are smaller that have been able to routinely, like mine, for instance, I'll bring up mine as an example. I have 100 acres. 80 acres is huntable. Like the buck I was hunting for in 2024, for instance, no one knew about that buck until November 6th, whereas I had daily pictures of him all summer, all fall. But he went on his one excursion. They're like, look at this buck we got. Do you know him? I'm like, no, I don't. Don't know that deer at all. What are you talking about?
Love it.
Then he came back home after he did his excursion. So
yeah,
to me, there's no right or wrong answer on that. It's just, yeah, it's your makeup of the property. And that's how Mother Nature designed it. And it's just how well you can manipulate it to affect it.
Yeah. Are there certain things guys with small acreages can do, like 20, I'm just going to use 20 and under acres that they can do to get as close as possible to a whole deer all year round goal?
Absolutely. Yeah, I would think so. Like I've done quite a few 20 to 25 acre consults. And to me, it's just, you got to change your thinking, you know? So when you have a lot of acreage, it's easy to develop that plan and really hold those deer. But when you start getting smaller acreages, you start leaning on neighboring properties. It's just, you have to, so maybe that 20 is next to some guy that owns 160 and he's doing habitat up the yin yang. All right. Now you got to know, you got to work with that process. Mm-hmm. So like one I was just recently on, for instance, I went into his 20 acres and the whole woods was a park. So right away, I'm like, you got to get a logger in here. We got to take out actually a good amount of white oak, maples, hickories. We got to get this cleaned up. You have no side cover. You have no food. You have no water. So it's like, well, it makes sense why your deer just passed through this property.
Yeah.
So as you can give those little niches to those deer, to me, there is that, you know, because every deer to me is unique, right? It's unique as you and I are. And they all have their own personality. So some of you will get that one deer, and not saying it's going to be every year, but you might get that one buck that doesn't want to move. He's just a homebody. Mm-hmm. So if you can set that up to him, where suddenly now he's like, I got my food, I got my cover. You're not pressuring it overly, you know, staying out of it as much as you can or hunting edges. But to me, it's all about catering, like you said, to what's around you. Like I even did a consult on 5 acres this year. That's all the guy had. But I'm like, we're going to build this where those bucks on the neighbor's ridge have to come down here because we know what the neighbor has. They don't have good water. They didn't have food plots. They just have the right contour. Well, let's give them the water. Let's give them the food. Let's give them some nighttime bedding where they can bed up next to your food sources. So to me, it's every property is different. So it's hard to give a true answer on it other than just giving the deer every single thing they need at their disposal to survive there and be there and not be feel pressured.
Yeah. You know, every time, and I'm not talking about habitat. I'm just talking about goals in general of what I'm trying to accomplish every hunting season. And they always seem to change, or I don't know how to properly set my expectations and goals. What would you say to a landowner as far as real, what are realistic goals when hiring a fellow like yourself?
Yeah. To me, realistic goals is increase of deer quantity, working on actually getting more bucks on your property, staying maybe a little more routine exposure. So not instead of like being like, oh, we get one big buck comes by every year at November. No, my whole process, and I get a little mad scientist on it, is I want that buck to live there. So where maybe a guy hasn't had that routine mature buck, to me, the realistic goal is that now we're going to make a buck live on yours.
Right.
And to me, like I said, I drive myself crazy with it every time I'm on a new property. So I'm like, if I was going to hunt this, how would I make sure I'm going after mature deer every single year?
Yeah.
And so all my clients that I've talked to, I mean, that I've done the consults, they've done the work. That's the other part of it. Is a lot of these guys, bless their heart, but suddenly they won't do the work. Well, then you can't have realistic goals if you're not going to do the plan.
Yeah.
But if you do the plan, increase deer numbers, increase maturity. And as long as you're doing everything to the T, like I talk about doe harvest and all these different things, improve your rut and all this kind of stuff. But if you do it to the T, you will increase your deer numbers and your age structure.
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's this doe control, doe patrol types, taking of the does to make room for other animals. How does that work in your habitat plan? Because I hear it all the time, like large populations of deer, let's say, the number of deer per acre type of whatever, conversation that people that people have, the more deer, the less big bucks, because they don't want to be all year round in a area with a higher population of deer until it's time to, you know, start breeding does. Then they come in and visit. But how do you manage populations? How do you know what the correct population, the deer per acre or deer per farm, yep, or however you do it? How do you manage that?
Yeah, so for me, it's all resource availability, right? So there's a couple of key signs, and I use all my cameras to do a lot of the work for me on that. You know, so like, mm-hmm, I run a whole slew of tactic cams out there where I'm monitoring my herd. Well, when I'm starting to see all these deer in the field and in a food plot, and say I'm seeing does on their hind legs fighting and all these different things, well, I know it's getting intense. Or I go through a woods and there's no undergrowth.
Yeah,
it's overran with deer. We got to start, yeah, taking does out. And I mean, I was kind of case in point. I mean, I'm a great example of it. For most of my life, I grew up with, we don't shoot does.
Yeah.
That was what I was taught early on, because especially in northern Wisconsin, it was like, nope, you don't shoot the does because the does bring the bucks. You know, that was, yeah, the whole logic. Well, suddenly I'm like, got a bug in my butt. I'm like, I'm going to start killing does because there's way too many of these. When I'm seeing, yeah, 15 does and I'm not seeing a single buck in a sit, red flag. You know, yeah, what people don't realize is a big matriarch doe, she runs the roost until the rut. And, yeah, she'll push those bucks out. She doesn't care. I mean, especially like velvet time, there's easy where you can see a doe get on her hind limbs after a buck and she'll chase him off. It's no different than bear hunting. When you get a sow and cubs on a bait, she runs it. That's hers, yeah, now. And to me, it's no different with does. And if you don't have the right habitat makeup and now all these does are there, for one, you'll actually keep more doe families out because does don't like each other either. You know, if a doe, yeah, has her, you know, matriarch and she has her family, she sees that other matriarch with her family, they're fighting. They don't want those same resources for their families. You know, yeah, so now when you have that, you have these big clashes of these doe families, why would the buck want to go out there? He doesn't want to deal with that, especially when he's growing his velvet. He's going, yeah, to leave. He's going to go somewhere else. Yeah, during a rut, yeah, he's going to run it. But also now, like I look at northern Wisconsin, for a long time, we had buck only. You could only shoot a buck. Mm-hmm. So the does were protected for like a decade. We have so many does now that every time I shoot does, what I do is I cut the udder. I want to make sure she made milk, because if she didn't make, yeah, milk, she didn't get bred.
Yeah.
So now we have so many does. We're up there in northern Wisconsin. We have about a 3-cycle breeding. So we're getting 3 ruts per se in northern Wisconsin. Well, what does that do? That lengthens your whole rut out. The intensity is not there. You're not even see as many rubs and scrapes because the bucks have no competition. Yeah. So as you reduce those does, make more food available and getting your rut actually more intense. So when, gotcha, it comes down to it, food is your key. And especially when they need 4 to 6 pounds of food a day.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway, wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel that. All right. There's a lot to absorb, right? I mean, and obviously that's why, you know, people hire you and you know, an expert to come out and do all this for them. If someone wants to take that on, that 20 acre piece, because for example, I have this farm, it's 80 acres. It's not mine. I hunt it, but I have permission to do some very light habitat work on it as long as it does not interfere with the agriculture part of it. All right. And so I am trying to figure out what would be the best. So I've went in there and I started cutting down Osage orange trees and black locust trees with all the thorns and shit on them.
Yep.
With one goal, to try to get sunlight to the floor. And because in that property from the forest floor to about my chin, maybe even a little higher, you can almost see through the timber. right? Okay. And so we have no vegetation really below 6 feet. And so I'm trying to open that up a little bit. That's my goal. And I'll just even go a step further and say, I'm trying to create a hallway through this property. And on each side of the trail, different, like, here's a room. And that room is like 20 chopped down trees. And then I go 100 yards and then I create another room, which is another group of trees that have been cut down, to try to get these pockets to open up for that. I want you to talk about, for the guy who thinks he can take this on, these projects on himself. Like, to me, I spend so much money on hunting anyway, on a property that I don't own. I don't want to spend money on a guy like you. No offense, right?
I get it.
Yeah. But if a guy wants to take on one of these projects by himself, what are some do's and do not do's that he should consider before taking on a project like this? If he's never done it before.
Yeah. I mean, to me, if you've never done it before, don't do hinge cutting, because you're probably going to do it wrong, or you're going to make it too thick. That's a big don't do if you have no knowledge of it. You know, just because you watched one video doesn't mean you're an expert on that, because you can screw it up really fast.
I did.
Super fast.
Yeah, I did. Straight up.
I mean, I agree. Like, my first one I did with my dad, there's still wedges and trees in my woods from the first hinge cut I ever did with my dad. I was like, it was a horror show. It was terrible. So I'd say definitely don't do that. I would say, make trail systems. Mm-hmm. Like, make a perimeter trail if possible on your property. Get it so you can utilize the land from the outside in. That's a big do, I would say. Do would also be, figure out where you can get fruit trees planted. Not a lot of guys worry about that, but try to get additional forage through soft mass and hard mass trees. Another thing that I would probably say is, like, get water in, but you got to think about where you're going to put it, right? But to me, like, the biggest don't do is definitely hinge cutting without any expertise. Cutting just trees. I mean, get some kind of insight on your forest health before you start cutting.
Yeah.
You know, and also if it's for whitetail land, don't think that you have to cut up everything that falls over. You know, I see it so many times where I go in the woods, like, well, my dad just loves cutting firewood. And I'm like, I can tell there's no horizontal cover. Whatsoever. You know, so sometimes leave that stuff. But I mean, the do list is greater. I'd say, like, when I tell people, what are your priorities? It's getting your trail system created, because that's honestly the most labor intensive portion of all of it is cutting. Chainsaw work takes a lot of time. But also, to me, is getting water on your property. That's a very important one to me too, because too many people overlook water. They think food plots are the key component of this, and it's not. To me, food plots are at the end of the day, because I can easily go out there in my tractor and pound out a couple food plots in a weekend. That's not that hard. But when it comes to getting water placement and these trail systems, that's going to take most of your time. And trees, again, if you have areas that you want to get trees, the best tree planted was the one you planted 10 years ago.
Yeah, I feel that. Okay. All right. Any other do's or do not do's that you want to talk about?
You know, I mean, to me, I guess the other part of it is, you know, kind of like we talked at the beginning of this, is just because you have invasives, don't eradicate them all.
Right.
Think above a plan. Get a plan in place. And that's where guys like me, we help you make a plan. Because if you look at really like what someone like I do, when you look at it on paper, it's overwhelming. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want to overwhelm people, because a lot of times that's what you need to do, is you got to really transform a property. So take bites. I'd say that's the other thing too, is if you do have a plan, regardless of who you might have used for a consultant or if you did it yourself, don't do it all the first year ever. And the reason why I say that is every habitat change you make is going to affect your deer movement. Mm-hmm. Take it in small bites. Do certain portions of your property and see how the deer interact with it. Then go to the next quadrant. So slowly work your property into this epicenter for whitetail movement. If you throw everything at them, it's just like if I went into your house and I changed where your bathroom, your bedroom, your kitchen, your living room were, you're going to be like, where the hell am I? Right. Same thing for a deer. If you change their whole world, you might have just lost your mature buck because you just messed it up way too much. Take bites, see how they interact with it.
Okay, cool. Cool. Well, man, I appreciate you taking time out of your day. I have a lot more questions for you that I'm hoping that we can cover at a different time. But man, if people want to ask you questions or maybe get a digital business card from you, where should we send them?
Yeah, so you can go any of the social media sites. So Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, I'm on all of them, Creek Bottom Land Management. But then also my website, creekbottomlandmgmt.com.
Perfect. All right, Zach, man, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much. And we'll talk to you next time.
Awesome. Appreciate it, Dan.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network. And this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.